and welcome back to In the Shadow of the Evening Trees, episode 27. I'm Jennifer Von Ebers.
I'm David Von Ebers.
And welcome back to our show.
We're back. I don't think we necessarily have any more stuff to talk about Ireland.
I don't think so.
Anything more about Ireland to talk about?
Yeah, our last two shows were about our trip to Ireland, which was fantastic to see Bruce Springsteen. So you can listen to the past two is if A, you love Ireland like we do, two, you like travel, three, traveling to see a destination show like Bruce Springsteen, which was amazing.
It was.
Once in a lifetime.
It was. Although it'd be nice not to say that, but it is probably true. It'd be nice to be able to say we're going to do it again and again and again, but I don't know if that's really the case.
I couldn't keep up with that kind of show for even one night, let alone like doing it.
No, I mean going to see him.
I know,
not
but like
perform.
as a performer, I don't think I could do that after that many years.
Yeah, it is kind of funny because after he played there, he went to I guess he was in France and then Italy and stuff. And I keep thinking, wait a minute, our show, we only saw the one. That should have been the end of it because that was the best. I don't want to hear about all these other shows. People keep posting pictures.
Right.
And I'm feeling, like envious.
Yeah,
now.
Ours was way better.
Yeah, our show was better than yours. But yeah, so I don't know how long this tour goes. I know it can't go too much longer in Europe because he's coming back to the States in the summer. Because he's going to play at Wrigley Field in Chicago, and yes, we tried to get tickets.
We did try to get tickets to that.
No, we could not get them. But we tried.
Yeah. I mean, we figured, what the heck, since it's in our backyard, we may as well just try. I'm sure now, even if you bought like a ticket from a scalper, it'd be like thousands of dollars per ticket.
Nothing is in our backyard anymore. We figured out who we drove up to Milwaukee to go to a concert back in April, and we realized that where we live now, we are about halfway between downtown Milwaukee and downtown Chicago.
Yes.
So that's kind of, I mean, it's, you know, it's nice because Milwaukee's fine, but Milwaukee's even better than fine. Milwaukee's
yeah.
a good town.
And for those of you who don't know, we just actually had our 2-year anniversary of where we live now. David and I grew up in the Oak Park River Forest, Illinois area, which is very close to Chicago, downtown Chicago.
Yep.
So our whole lives have been spent just obviously jumping on a train or driving downtown in no time flat. And now we're about 45 miles away.
Probably closer to 50.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
It's different.
It's different. It's very different. It's very different. I remember... When I was my first real law job, I mean, I'd done like internships and things like that, and also worked as a clerk for a law firm. But my first real law job out of law school was at a big firm in the city, and they had people, you know, a lot of the lawyers had come from other parts of the country, and there was a guy who I can't remember where he grew up. I know he went to American University for law school, which is what, in Washington, D.C., something like that?
Probably.
I don't know. But anyway, he was not familiar with the Chicago area, and I kept talking about Oak Park, where I had grown up and still lived at the time. And finally, he stopped me and he goes, I'm really confused. Is that a neighborhood of the city or is that a separate town? I'm like, no, it's actually a separate town.
But that's a good question, though.
But yeah, aside from the fact that a lot of Chicago neighborhoods are named after parks, so it's reasonable to be confused by that. Oak Park is so close to the city. It's literally right on the west side, about 10 miles west of the loop. And people get a little confused. I took it as a compliment, but I told the truth. I told them it was a suburb, not part of the city.
Although I am curious, for the people who are listening, you can leave a comment if you currently live in the town that you grew up in. Because before we moved 2 years ago, David and I, besides college, had lived in our hometown our whole lives,
raised our
kids there.
Yeah.
David and I went to the same high school. All three of our children went to the same high school as us. So that was, I mean, we made that decision when they were little to make that commitment,
right,
not to change, you know, and have them move schools and, you know, try new things and stuff like that. So, but after our youngest graduated, it was like graduated high school.
We're not tied
down. We spread
down
our wings.
We did.
We were the last ones, actually, out of both sides of our family who left our hometown.
That is true. It is funny. I mean, you know, part of the reason for that was when we bought, was it our first house? I guess it was our first house in Oak Park. My memory is less than perfect. But when we bought our first house in Oak Park, it was a short distance from my mom's house.
Yes.
My father had passed away. And, you know, I wanted to live relatively close to, you know, be able to run over there and help out if necessary. She did not. She's very independent. She did not call on us very much. But that was kind of the rationale. And then, you know, from that point, our kids were in school, and then we really kind of felt tied in.
We were ensconced.
This reminds me, though, of a funny thing that happened recently. So Chicago has mayoral elections in odd-numbered years. I mean, they're every 4 years, but it's an odd-numbered year so that it doesn't get sort of, I guess, bogged down in the federal elections or the gubernatorial election in Illinois. So Chicago just had an election and elected a new mayor named Brandon Johnson. And he's very progressive and, you know, he's a former member of the Chicago Teachers Union, or maybe a current member of the Chicago Teachers Union. But he also served on the Cook County Board, so I don't know if he's still a union member. Anyway, we don't live in Chicago, so we didn't have an opportunity to vote or not. But what's funny was Fox News, I think it might have been the local affiliate, not the national station, but I don't really know, because we almost never watch news on TV. We get all of our news from the internet, you know. But anyway, they sent a reporter to a suburb called Naperville, Illinois. Now, Naperville is at least as far from the city of Chicago as we are. It happens to be due west instead of north. We live north of the city. But it's at least as far as away from the city as we are. It's not even in Cook County, which is where Chicago is. It's in DuPage County, which is to the west. And so they sent a reporter there, and the reporter was at a diner. This was the morning of the mayor's inauguration. And the reporter was at a diner in Naperville and interviewing people at like 9 o'clock in the morning who claimed to be from Chicago. So somehow these folks drove 50 miles or so to a diner in the suburbs to get breakfast so this Fox News reporter could interview. Anyway, the comments on social media were absolutely hysterical. And the guy was, you know, was swearing up and down that the people that he interviewed were actually Chicagoans. They just happened to be out in the far western suburbs. And people were hysterically funny. But it kind of stoked this thing that happens from time to time when folks are outside of Chicago are mouthing off about the city. And there were a lot of people. Now there's like T-shirts and, you know, different things with logos that say essentially shut the F up about Chicago. And they're like, you know, they're made to look like local, like Chicago area brands, like, you know, old style beer, although old style is actually made, I think, in Wisconsin. But it happens to be, you know, old style was very popular in Chicago. You get it, Cubs games and stuff like that. Anyway, so it was very funny, all these things about. But then I got to tell you a funny thing. So I laughed along with many of these things, but I didn't really comment too much because people who live in the city, you know, they don't want suburbanites like us acting as though we live in the city.
Yes.
Right. And it always kind of cracks me up because although I lived, you know, grew up in the suburbs, I spent an awful lot of my time inside the city limits. We took public transportation. We would go to the beach all the time. My friends and I would jump on the L, go to the beach. We'd go to Wrigley Field. I spent tremendous amount of time in the bleachers at Wrigley Field when it was easy to get in the olden days.
And affordable.
And affordable. At Oak Street Beach in the city. So I kind of think it's funny because what you got nowadays in the city is a lot of folks who basically moved from Iowa 2 years ago, right? And they're all wagging their fingers at the suburbanites and saying, you're not one of us, which is kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But they're Chicagoans now.
But they are. Yeah, they're Chicagoans now. And you know that they're all from Iowa and Michigan and Wisconsin because unlike people who have lived in the city their whole lives, these folks drive everywhere, right? Like everybody took public transportation everywhere.
Right.
You know, and now they drive anywhere. So you can't get anywhere in the city with like with every place takes 45 minutes to get to because the streets are all jammed up in every single direction. Mm-hmm. When we were taking guitar lessons, the place, the Old Town School of Folk Music, was I think we figured out it was eight miles from our house. It would take us 45 minutes on a Saturday or a Sunday morning because we had, you know, there wasn't really a way to get there on public transportation. So we drove, but we had to drive through these, you'll pardon the expression, gentrified neighborhoods with all these, you know, people who'd only, you know, all the hipsters who'd moved in over the last couple of years. And they drove everywhere, and they had their freaking farmers markets everywhere that we had to navigate our way through. So don't get me started about the people who came to Chicago in the last couple of years and now are real Chicagoans and look down on us suburbanites. But in any event,
just saying,
it is, you know, I will give them, it's fair comment on their part. I never actually physically lived in the city. I only lived very, very, very close to the city and spent a lot of time in the city.
Right.
You know, and like...
And worked in the city.
Yeah, and we had family members in like a whole bunch of different, you know, neighborhoods. I mean, Rogers Park on the north side, Beverly on the south side. Anyway, whatever. But it is kind of funny. But I don't mess with people who live in the city over Chicago-based things. Because... you know, even if they are from Iowa, they got a point if they actually live within the city limits. So.
It's fair game.
Yeah, it is fair game. So that took up 12 minutes of our time.
That's interesting.
I hope somebody thinks it's interesting.
Please keep listening.
Yeah, we have a cat joining us, although she's
being... Hi, Waffle.
She's being quiet. Waffle, whose favorite thing in the world these days is to sit behind me on my desk chair.
Like on your chair.
And not really give me any room. So I sit on the very edge of the chair now doing my work.
Because you love that cat so much.
She is a good cat. She's a very good cat. But that's not why you call. As the saying goes.
That is true. So we are finally getting pretty much summer-like temperatures here. So I'm going to say it's basically summer, since even though it's not officially summer, we have enjoyed 80s, high 80s temperatures, which has been delightful after a long winter.
It has been. Although it was cooler this week. That kind of came out of nowhere. It was cooler this week. It was mostly just in the 70s. But I have to say, unless you have something.
Nope, go ahead.
I have to go back to something that we talked about with our friend Jesse Jackson, not about Bruce Springsteen, although we did talk to him about that. And again, we'll let you know when the episode of his podcast is up. We mentioned it the last time we talked to Jesse for a good hour for his podcast, Set Lusting Bruce. But we didn't just talk about the concert. We also talked about some serious stuff. Because one, and I mentioned this, I think, the last time, one of the things Jesse likes to do is, you know, he likes to kind of bring in people from different backgrounds on his show and not just talk about the music, but also talk about, you know, their backgrounds, and he wants a diverse group of people. So he asked us, you know, how we were feeling. Well, I don't know if he put it that way, but he introduced the topic of, you know, the current sort of, you know, onslaught of prejudice and laws and everything like that are attacking the LGBTQIA community generally and the trans community in particular. And, you know, so we talked about that and we talked about whether or not, you know, is this maybe a symptom of, you know, or is it kind of like the last gasp of these angry folks who realize that the world has changed? Most people really are not on their side. Most people don't agree with them. And they're freaking out because they can't handle the change. But it's really a sign that we are making progress, but people are just sort of fighting back as progress makes, you know, or is it something more than that? And so there's some interesting things have happened on this front, good and bad. On the bad side, I don't know if you saw the story about this school board meeting would be a more accurate way to say it, in Glendale, California, you know, liberal Glendale, California. Well, I don't know that city specifically, but Glendale in liberal California, put it that way, where, you know, they were talking about, you know, celebrating Pride or acknowledging Pride Month or whatever. And there were these, you know, right-wing extremist thugs who started attacking pro-LGBTQ, you know, demonstrators or people who were there in support of recognizing Pride Month. And it became kind of a melee, you know. And again, it's a sign of just like the increasing sort of animosity and anger among what I think of as a kind of a loud but increasingly small minority of Americans who just can't accept the fact that the world is changing. But at the same time, you know, you look at the violence and you have to ask yourself, you know, it's great to say, well, you know, this is a, you know, it's an isolated incident and it's a small group of people and the vast majority of people, you know, not only disagree with them, you know, like actively hate those people because they're being violent and so forth. But then, you know, that whole kind of way of framing it, it may be factually accurate, right? It may be factually accurate that they're a small part of a bigger problem. No, let me rephrase that. They're a small part. They're a small part of our country, and they're not really going to ultimately prevail in the long run. But that is kind of like, that's premised on the idea that we live in a real democracy and the majority is actually going to have its say. So when you look at these crazy people who, you know, are violently attacking queer people and people who support queer people, and then you look at these politicians, well, I won't even say what party,
yeah,
who are becoming increasingly anti-democratic. I mean, small d democratic, not anti-democratic party, but anti-democracy. You know, they're trying to restrict the vote. They're genuinely authoritarian. And you do have to confront the possibility that even though these folks are in the minority, you know, we have a system that's kind of set up to make it possible for the minority to rule things. You know, we have the Electoral College, which definitely gives a leg up to more conservative candidates, although obviously Joe Biden won the last time. You know, we have the Senate, where you do not have proportional representation, and they're one half of the legislature in the U.S. So, you know, and then on top of that, we've got a Supreme Court that is gone rogue lately, right? I mean, you know, overturning Roe versus Wade, which, although I think a lot of people saw it coming, it's still pretty shocking when it happens.
Very shocking.
Right? So you worry about, it's easy to say, okay, they're a loud, obnoxious, and potentially dangerous minority, but they're still the minority and the vast majority of people disagree with that. Right, fine, that's okay. But they also have disproportionate representation in government because there's an increasing number of politicians and the state level, but also on the federal level, who look at these things the same way they do. So that's what concerns me. Not that I think that those thugs are representative of a very large percentage of Americans, but those thugs have the ear of people in Washington and in many state capitals.
Yes.
And we see those politicians, in essence, either doing the bidding of the thugs or just being thugs themselves. But now for some good news, I guess, although it starts out as bad news. So in Florida, you know, they recently passed a law banning gender-affirming care for trans kids under the age of 18. You know, that's the bad news, I guess. But the good news is that just yesterday, a federal judge in Florida by the name of Robert L. Hinkle, federal judge in the District Court for the Northern District of Florida, issued a preliminary injunction banning enforcement of a part of that bill. So, just the statute bans all kinds of gender affirming treatment, including things like puberty blockers and cross hormone therapy, but then it also bans things like surgery. In this case, they were only challenging the non-surgical. The plaintiffs were only challenging the non-surgical part of it. They weren't dealing with the part of the statute that does not allow gender-affirming surgery on people under the age of 18. Now, just as an aside, I think that's kind of an interesting thing. And I think one of the reasons why they did not challenge that part is because, in fact, it's extremely rare. You know, everybody wants to tell these horror stories about, doctors performing surgery on people who are minors, but it almost never happens. It's an extremely rare thing. So the vast majority of trans or non-binary kids under the age of 18 are only dealing with other forms of affirming care. And that can include, we've talked about this before, but that can include therapy. That can include just simple things like changing their names or, you know, how they dress or the pronouns they use and the people around them, you know, doing the same, using their correct name and pronouns and so forth. But it also can include some kinds of medical intervention like puberty blockers and hormones and so forth. So that's the part of the case that this dealt with. And the court said that So this is a preliminary injunction. I don't want to be overly legal about it, but what it means is that it's not the final result of the case. There's not been a full-blown trial on the claims of the plaintiffs, but they have proven, number one, that they have a substantial likelihood of winning in the end. Number two, that they would suffer irreparable harm if the state of Florida is allowed to enforce this law, that they can't be compensated with money damages for the harm they would suffer. And, you know, I put this is really the first one, but I put it last, that they have a substantial right in need of the court's protection. So the court makes those findings and then enters an order enjoining enforcement of the statute until they can have a full-blown trial. That's essentially what a preliminary injunction is, right? But the judge's opinion is really interesting because so just as an aside, there was a related case in Florida where a judge took a lot of evidence. There were witnesses who testified under oath and so on and so forth. And in this case, which is called Doe versus Ladapo, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, L-A-D-A-P-O. In this case, this judge relied and the parties agreed to rely on the evidence that had already been presented in the other case. But the judge really does a great job in the case that I'm talking about of breaking it down and how, you know, the first section of the judge's opinion, the first substantive section says gender identity is real. And the judge goes to explain that based on the testimony and the evidence that was introduced in this other case and that the parties agreed to be bound by, you know, all of the experts agree that gender identity is a real thing. The judge says, I'm just going to read a little bit from this opinion because I think it's pretty well done. The judge says, with extraordinarily rare exceptions not at issue here, every person is born with external sex characteristics, male or female, and chromosomes that match. As the person goes through life, the person also has a gender identity, a deeply felt internal sense of being male or female. For more than 99% of people, the external sex characteristics and chromosomes, the determinants of what this order calls a person's natal sex, match the person's gender identity. For less than 1%, the natal sex and gender identity are the opposites. A natal male's gender identity is female, or vice versa. Then the court goes on to say that the defendants, you know, acknowledge that this is what the evidence shows and this is what the experts say, but they kind of play fast and loose by sometimes acknowledging that and other times not acknowledging that. The court's pretty critical of their kind of vacillating back and forth. But then the court goes on to talk about the standards of care for transgender individuals. The court says, transgender individuals suffer higher rates of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide than the population at large. some suffer gender dysphoria, a mental health condition recognized by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, the DSM-5. The diagnosis applies when specific criteria are met. Among other things, there must be a marked incongruence between one's experienced gender identity and natal sex for at least 6 months, manifested in specific ways, and clinically significant distress or impairment. And now, here's the thing that I think is really important, okay? The judge goes on to say, there are well-established standards of care for treatment of gender dysphoria. They are set out in two publications, and the judge describes the two publications. Then he says, under these standards, gender dysphoria treatment begins with a comprehensive biophysical assessment. In addition to appropriate mental health therapy, there are three types of possible intervention, all available only to adolescents or adults and never to younger children. First, for patients near the onset of puberty, medications known as GnRH antagonists, that is to say puberty blockers, can delay the onset of continuation of puberty. Then he goes on and says, cross-sex hormones, testosterone for transgender males, estrogen for transgender females, can promote the development and maintenance of characteristics consistent with the patient's gender identity. And then he goes on to say, third, for some patients, surgery can align physical characteristics with gender identity. And again, he's pointing out that this case only involves the two first parts of that treatment, puberty blockers and cross hormones, but not surgery. Anyway, he says, the overwhelming weight of medical authority supports treatment of transgender patients with GnRH antagonists and cross-sex hormones in appropriate circumstances. So, in other words, this is the established standard of care, and this includes for younger people. All right, I'm not going to go on and read from it further. But the point is, these are findings based on evidence and testimony given to the court under oath. And the judge is saying, and the parties really can't dispute, that these are the facts of the case. That this is not something that anybody made up, that this condition, and I don't mean to make it sound like it's some sort of form of mental illness, but that being transgender, having a transgender identity is real, and that there is an accepted standard of care based on years and years and years of research and clinical findings and so on and so forth. And that's what the sort of the factual basis is for the plaintiff's claims. And then the court goes on to analyze the law and strikes down or not strikes it down, as I say, it's a preliminary injunction, but enjoins enforcement of the law pending the outcome of the case. But this is a pretty remarkable thing. These are things that people generally don't know. This is not something that is unknown, unheard of. It's not something that's new.
Right, it's not brand new.
This is medical science. And here's the thing, here's the bottom line to me. I don't fully grasp all of these nuances. Neither do you, if you're listening to this. Neither do you, right? We should probably leave complicated medical things to doctors and medical professionals who understand them, to provide guidance to parents and kids and so forth, rather than having your governor or your state legislatures or the president or Congress make these decisions for you.
Yes.
Right? And that's not a particularly liberal or conservative point of view. In fact, that's the kind of things conservatives are always saying. Let the experts decide and make the decisions, and let individual people make their own personal decisions based on expert advice. That's what conservatives should be saying. That's the thing that makes the most sense. And that's what the court is saying.
Well, and I think about this often when states like Florida have all these attacks against transgender youth. Our daughter came out when she was an adult, so we didn't have to, worry about this. But if there's a tremendous amount of people who have to think like, do I have to leave the state that I'm from because of these things, and I just think that's so unfair.
Yeah, Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, so this gives me, you know, this kind of thing gives me like a little glimmer of hope because, you know, while there are an awful lot of sort of authoritarian politicians out there trying to tell parents what they can do, trying to tell individual people what they can do, you know, and trying to make healthcare decisions for people, agents of the state making healthcare decisions for people that should be left up to people and their doctors. You know, the courts are not necessarily, you know, they're not part of that process. You know, they make their own decisions. They're not necessarily subject to the political pressures that are on them, that are on other politicians. And so, you know, there's some hope that the courts will be the balancing and the neutralizing force here, and will push back against this sort of authoritarian trend. And it's not just an authoritarian trend, it's an anti-democratic trend, because by and large, most people don't agree with this nonsense. Most people don't agree with these crazy bills that are out there targeting trans people. But then I kind of pause for a minute, right? Because in the world before the Dobbs case that overturned Roe versus Wade, I would have felt a pretty high degree of confidence, not only in an opinion, not only in judges reaching an opinion like this, but also that if the case like this wound up all the way in front of the United States Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court would make the right decision and would agree with this judge, right? In the pre-Dobbs world, I would have felt that way. Why? Because there had been a trend in the Supreme Court for expanding the rights of LGBTQIA people. There was obviously, you know, go all the way back to Lawrence versus Texas in the early part of the 21st century, where the court struck down laws that prohibited gay sex, basically, on the grounds of due process and equal protection. And then, of course, the Obergefell case that struck down laws that didn't allow same-sex marriage. And then you have the Bostick case more recently, where the court found that federal laws that protected people against sex discrimination also protected people against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And Bostick was really a substantial move forward. And, you know, it's not all puppies and rainbows and happiness, because at the same time the court was expanding the legal rights of LGBTQ people, they were sort of carving out a bunch of religious exceptions and saying, well, you know, the First Amendment allows people to refuse to bake a cake, or the First Amendment may allow people to discriminate even if the law prohibits it. So the compromise, if there was one, that conservatives on the court seemed to make was, yes, you have all these rights, but on the other hand, there may be some First Amendment right to discriminate against you anyway.
Right,
so it's kind of a mixed bag, and I figured that was kind of the way they were going to go. However, you know, in my view, Dobbs throws it all up in the air, because Dobbs obviously, you know, took away one of the most fundamental rights that people have, not just women, not just people who can get pregnant, but people generally, the right to have, you know, bodily autonomy and make your own healthcare decisions. So I got to be honest, as great as this opinion is by this judge in Florida, and there have been other similar cases around the country, you have to wonder whether the Supreme Court is going to look at this kind of thing differently. You know, they could strike down laws that prohibited same-sex marriage, because it seems really petty and dumb. Like, why would the state have anything to say about whether or not you can marry someone who's the same sex as you? That just seems dumb and mean-spirited and petty. So I think it was an easy decision for the court to make, even though at the time it seemed very controversial. But Dobbs signals a new thing, right? The Dobbs case is like, you know, they're not very inclined to respect bodily autonomy. And that's what this kind of case is all about. I mean, the whole decision is talking about the appropriate standards of care and saying that the government can't interfere with that. And that seems to me to be the kind of rationale that makes a lot of sense, but could be at risk. So that's the bad news, then the good news, then the bad news.
Right.
But we shall see.
We talked over, well, a little bit over our time. We usually try to go 30 minutes.
Ish.
Thanks for listening ish. To our whole podcast tonight. But it is something that especially is concerning to anybody who has a stake in this. You know, just not only in Florida, but around the country, like what's happening and just really paying attention to that. Because like the things like this will get buried under the other news that is against it. You know, so it's like one of those things that not many people would hear about this, but it's like there are these things that are going on that are more positive.
Well, right. And this is something we can talk about the next time. But, you know, there was a news story this week. You talk about things kind of getting buried. Ron DeSantis, you know, just announced that the governor of Florida is going to run for president. Apparently, you know, he has a pastor who's expressed some extremely violent opinions about LGBTQ people, about how, you know, they should, you know, calling them groomers and all this stuff. And anyway, it's even worse than that. But let's just say his pastor has said some horrific things about LGBTQIA people. And I pointed out on Twitter, and I'll just mention again, remember that Barack Obama had to go on national television and apologize for things that Reverend Wright said out, not even in Obama's presence,
right,
but said from the pulpit. And by the way, those comments were taken completely out of context.
I totally forgot about that.
Right? Oh, I remember watching the speech. Barack Obama had to go and sort of apologize for what his pastor said, even though what his pastor said was not what the media portrayed it to be. But now DeSantis, you know, I guarantee you, no one in the media will ever ask this question of him, ever. They are going to shrug it off and pretend it didn't happen. And so, you know, that's what we're up against.
Yeah. Not good.
Not good. Now we've really run long.
So thanks for listening to this episode 27, and we will see you next time. Good night.
Good night.